KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma.
I'm from Berkeley.
Concord, Cali.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, we're headed to Scrap, a creative reuse center serving San Francisco teachers.
So I got a bunch of tiles, paper, pencils, manila folders for portfolios.
Then what it's like to be a member of the first worker-owned cooperative queer bar in San Francisco.
I always refer to the Stud Collective as sort of like a Mighty Ducks crew of like underdogs from different persuasions.
And a look inside a dance studio in East Oakland that's teaching students the art of flamenco.
It came from poverty and repression. It's very much like the blues here. It came from poor people.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Stick around. A beloved San Francisco nonprofit is facing uncertainty about whether they'll be able to stay in their current building. Scrap is a creative reuse and recycling center that calls a Bayview warehouse home. The building is owned by the San Francisco School District, who let Scrap stay there rent-free. Part of the organization's mission is to help provide teachers with free school supplies. Back in 2016, KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma went to Scrap to see how it serves teachers and why teachers need the help. And just a note to our listeners, KALW's license is held by the San Francisco Unified School District.
There is a warehouse in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood, stuffed with the severed legs of aging mannequins, screws of various sizes, large pieces of real fur. It's called Scrap, Scroungers Center for Reusable Art Parts, a nonprofit recycling center. And while it might seem like a necessary pit stop before Burning Man, today it's full of another crew of diehards, teachers, more than 200 of them.
So I got a bunch of tiles, paper, pencils, manila folders for portfolios.
That's Corbray Smith, known to his students as Mr. C. He teaches sixth grade art in an Oakland charter school, and he's taking advantage of a teacher giveaway today at Scrap. The center has set aside free donated materials that might be useful to teachers. Things like binders, stacks of old National Geographic magazines, markers, and picture books. Smith's carrying load after load to his car.
This is my seventh trip. Yeah, I took everything.
Smith is excited about this free bundle of goods because usually...
I'm typically, though, spending all of my money.
Smith's not alone. The average American teacher spends $500 out of pocket on classroom supplies. Right now, California school funding looks better than it did during the recession, when school budgets were slashed by $20 billion. And Smith says his classroom budget's pretty generous. So why doesn't he make more art supply orders through school? He says bureaucracy.
It takes a long time to get reimbursed, and sometimes you just have a need, and you just need to do it.
And after meetings and lesson planning and working with kids all day, filling out paperwork to justify purchasing paper and paint, it just isn't really worth it to him. At a bin near Corbray Smith, a preschool teacher withdraws in horror from a pile of plastic bottle caps.
I'm seeing stuff like, okay, not infant friendly.
Lenny De Leon teaches preschool. And she won't pick up anything an infant or toddler could swallow. Her school, Holy Family Day Home, is one of the oldest preschools in the city, and it mainly serves kids from low-income families. She takes her job as their first teacher very seriously.
It's like we have to feed that brain. We have to nurture it and, you know, get them to a good start, giving them positive experiences, since like this is what a school is like. This is what a school should be.
She's eyeing color charts because she believes her classroom should be filled with beautiful things.
I want them to see just materials that, you know, they wouldn't typically see at home. Beautiful materials. I want them to get excited.
But mostly she's collecting practical items here at Scrap. Notebooks for teachers, staplers, and index cards. She has a small budget for classroom supplies.
And I'm just like, you know, I'm saving that for something really important.
Like if a CD player breaks, or they need to buy a new computer. So when she can't pick the basics up at Scrap, she usually just buys them.
You know, I just kind of spend along the way. I try not to keep track of it just because I really don't want to know how much I'm really spending.
Rachel Castro, who teaches at a different San Francisco preschool, already spent $200, and school's just started.
I know that that when you do your taxes, you can deduct up to $500, and I'm usually over that.
Anne-Marie Thielon, the founder of Scrap, thinks this is outrageous. She says she once went to a luncheon with bankers.
And I asked them, do your employees pay for their supplies to do their work? Why would teachers have to pay for their own supplies? And it's really a disgrace.
She opened Scrap in 1976 to help educators and artists source cheap materials. The school district owns this warehouse, so Scrap gets it rent-free. In return, they sell items at low cost year-round and host these free giveaways for teachers 9 times a year. You can find Thielon at the counter, wearing a beret, chatting with customers.
Yeah, I'm a teacher.
Oh, you're a teacher.
Yeah.
What do you teach?
I teach theater.
Oh. A few free packs of glue sticks, some crayons, they might seem small. But Thielon knows over time these things add up, especially as the rising cost of living is becoming prohibitive for many Bay Area teachers.
We need to really protect teachers because teachers are essential.
Preschool teacher Lenny De Leon agrees. She says she knows she'll go above and beyond to make her students' experiences positive, and so will educators everywhere.
I think teachers just kind of are just giving people, and they're just, you know, we just do whatever it takes out of our pocket.
But she also resents the unspoken expectation she feels from many non-teachers, that doing her job well has to come at her own expense.
You should just do it because you love to do the job.
Yeah.
No, I cannot stress that enough.
What De Leon wants, she says, is true respect for the important and difficult work she does. And maybe that starts with her not having to buy her own Post-its. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Mott.
That story first aired in August 2016. There's a free school supply giveaway for teachers in the San Francisco Unified School District that's March 3rd at Scrap. You can visit our website to find out more. That's klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The Stud is a queer bar in San Francisco with a long and storied history. It was founded in 1966, the same year as the historic Compton's Cafeteria Riot in the Tenderloin, 3 years before the Stonewall Uprising in New York. It survived the AIDS crisis, the dot-com boom and bust and boom again, all the while building a reputation as a quirky, welcoming place for all visitors. In July 2016, the Stud's landlord nearly tripled its rent, and it seemed like its days were numbered. Then, a new kind of entity stepped in to save the bar, an 18-member collective formed to buy the business, renegotiate the lease, and keep the spirit of the Stud going in a city where more and more queer bars are closing. The collective has now been running the bar for a little over a year. We talked to a few of the worker owners about what saving the Stud means to them.
I grew up in San Francisco, and I think my earliest memory of the Stud was as a child. I don't even know exactly how old I was, but I remember driving by it and seeing this big rainbow flag right off the freeway and knowing that that was a place where gay people went and just being in awe of that and finding it a little bit scary or a little bit intimidating, but also a little bit exciting. My name is Honey Mahogany, and I am a co-owner at The Stud.
My name is Micah Sigourney, also known as Vivian Forevermore, and I am a worker owner at The Stud Bar.
My name is Rachel Ryan, and I am one of the co-owners of The Stud. I also grew up in San Francisco, and my dad's business is based in SoMa, and so the bars of SoMa were always kind of this interesting character in my childhood of walking by the Eagle with my family on a Sunday and like seeing all the leather daddies or getting off the freeway and seeing that stud sign. When I grew up, the first place that I really felt like was my corner of the world was definitely the stud. As a queer person who dates men and women, it felt very welcoming to me, whereas I've been in lesbian bars in the past that hadn't felt as good. Straight bars have never felt good for me. So the stud had that homey feel.
When I grew up and started performing in drag, the stud was one of the first places in San Francisco that I gravitated towards because, you know, I mean, there was Tranny Shack, this rich history of San Francisco drag. I wanted to be a part of that and grow within that space. The stud really was, I found, the most welcoming gay bar in San Francisco. It was the most casual, the most inclusive. And like, you know, as a Black femme person, that was a welcoming space for me.
I was throwing a weekly party at the stud called Club Something that was about a 7 or 8 year run of a weekly Friday night show. We were one of the few regular parties at the stud. And so like my whole previous like 9, 8 years had been wrapped up in being at the stud and like producing events there and growing as an artist. There was a meeting held by Michael, the previous owner. He announced that the rent was going to triple and that the stud would have to close. And I immediately thought to myself, oh, I have to move to LA now with all like 25 of your friends who have left over the past 5 years.
I think when we heard that the landlord was raising the rents, that we knew that it was only a matter of time before the stud was going to announce that it closed. There was this sense of panic, I think, because I think that it finally made things real, that our city was changing and that, you know, if we didn't do something to stop some of these changes, that we could lose some of our favorite things about San Francisco.
Watching other queer spaces close, watching Esta Noche, watching the Lex close, realizing that, you know, the queer mecca of the world doesn't have a lesbian bar anymore. They were eye-opening experiences, and they started the conversations that we had.
At that point, we weren't a business. We were a group of people wanting to try to save a place from closing. We weren't wealthy in money, which seems to be a main thing you need these days, is money. But we knew that we were wealthy in the resources of like friends and social networks. And a cooperative is a business model that has multiple bottom lines, and one of those things is prioritizing the people as opposed to just the profits.
I always refer to the Stud Collective as sort of like a Mighty Ducks crew of like ragtag Disney feel-good movie of underdogs from different persuasions. But we took over a bar with very few people who had actual bar experience.
We've actually done a pretty damn good job considering that we are 18 very strong personality type people.
We have somebody who's, you know, a biostatistician. We have a VP from Levi's. We have performers and DJs, but I was proud of the way that we actually banded together and like put a kind of unexpected skill set into actually running a business and a bar, which was not something that we had a lot of experience with.
Coming at it from this idea that we were going to save the stud together as a community, we valued each other's voices through the process. And I think that allowed us to put our egos aside and to really sort of squelched any, I think, conflicts that was arising. Yes, we had heated moments in meetings, but I've been a part of a lot of collaborative processes. And I will say that the stud has by far been the easiest one. I feel like being the hub of the tech industry, there is this culture of finding, you know, investors or venture capitalists and then creating a business and then selling that business to make money. And a lot of the things that I find really important are not necessarily things that are going to make a ton of money, but I think that they are still extremely important.
It was announced July 4th that the stud's going away, and then Donald Trump was elected. And that was like a 1-2 punch. And then we purchased a month and a half later. And so being able to succeed in that moment, like in this moment of like total political turmoil, downturn, and fear for the safety of queer people of color, like gender nonconforming people, and know that we in some way have like made a tiny step towards preserving a space that is about safety and bravery for the myriad of identities of the people who come through our doors. That felt to me both personally and politically really important.
I think that using the collective power of a community to leverage and influence local governments and also banding together resources in order to save cultural institutions that we find really important is really going to be a key way for us to move forward as a city.
For me, one of the moments that stands out in the last year, it's kind of cheeseball, but we had a little stud family toast on New Year's Eve, which was our 1 year anniversary. And just having that moment and like marking it with this group of people that we went through this crazy journey with was just so special to like all be together celebrating the fact that we made it through our first year.
That was Honey Mahogany, Micah Sigourney, and Rachel Ryan, three worker owners of the Stud Bar in San Francisco. That piece was produced by Jackie Sajiko and Jen Chien. The collective is currently looking for a new space to house the bar. In the meantime, there's a lot going on there every night, including two shows tonight, one of which is hosted by Honey Mahogany, who you just heard. For more information, you can go to our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland is now one of the most expensive housing markets in the country. It's a fact that has folks worrying, not only about the displacement of longtime residents, but also an exodus of artists. Community members are rallying to preserve the local art scene. People like Yaelisa, a master flamenco dancer and instructor. She's been using her home dance studio to teach students the art of flamenco and the celebration of her culture. Sabah Williams went to her East Oakland dance studio to find out more.
It's a quiet evening on an Oakland street, quiet enough to hear the muffled sounds of dancers studying their flamenco footwork. Inside the dance studio, about 10 women in long skirts are standing in line behind their teacher, a Latina woman with a strong, commanding presence. She sings throughout her class and calls out guidance to her students as she keeps the rhythm with her hands and feet. The dancers move in unison. They are powerful, and the sounds of their footwork take on the quality of a drum. The master flamenca instructor teaching this class is Yaelisa.
My name is Yaelisa, and I'm a flamenco artist, producer, choreographer, and aficionada a flamenco.
Yaelisa has been dancing flamenco most of her life. Her mother passed the art form down to her. Yaelisa now directs Caminos Flamencos, a Bay Area dance company and nonprofit that presents live performances and offers classes for all, from beginners to professional dancers. Yaelisa says she's committed to preserving the legacy of flamenco and bringing it to people of all backgrounds.
It's not just dance. You have to study music, the culture. You have to study the singing. It's a fully rounded art form.
There are four distinct parts of flamenco, and they're equally important. Singing, dance, guitar, and jaleo. The spontaneous hand clapping and cries of encouragement that audiences and fellow artists give to each other. Flamenco originates from the mix of cultures in southern Spain, an area known as Andalusia. There are cultural influences from the Roma people, also known as gypsies, as well as Jewish, Spanish, and North African flavors.
It's born of the people. It came from poverty and repression and suppression. It's very much like the blues here. It came from poor people. It didn't just happen in big theaters, and that came later. So it's an art of the people, and it should be considered that, even though it has fancy costumes and lighting and theaters, and it did not come from that at all.
There's another important element of flamenco. It's something that's both ever-present and shrouded in mystery. That's the concept of duende. It has many shades of meaning. Sometimes it's translated as having soul, but mainly it's the expression of an emotion the dancer or singer is projecting. For Yalisa, it's central to the dance.
For me, it's like a cry of either joy or pain or sorrow or anguish or, you know, joie de vivre. It's a cry for every emotion you can think of, every feeling that a human can have.
Duende is the soul, the spirit, that it's deep within. And you know you're really dancing when you feel it. You know, it's not always there, but when it happens, you can feel it.
That's Teddy Milder, a local sculptor. She's been dancing all of her life and studying flamenco with Yalisa for 6 years. She says that flamenco is one of the hardest dances she's ever studied.
Your feet are doing one thing, your hands are doing one thing. You have to interact with the musicians and with the singer. So it's very complex, and it's also very deep, but you have to really call within yourself to dance.
That multifaceted expression is what makes flamenco such an appealing dance for students like Mo Awobo.
I have this saying, las mujeres dicen con los pies el que no se puede decir con la boca. The women say with their feet what they cannot say with their mouth. And I feel like flamenco is where especially Spanish women with a lot of the patriarchal repression get to just let it all out and say what they feel. And I feel like it has a lot in common with the African diaspora. Like as a black woman, I feel that duende, that anger that they have.
Awobo says she can connect to that anger in a specific flamenco movement.
One of my favorite gestures is the hand flip because it kind of reminds me of when my mother would get mad at somebody and look like she's going to slap them. And it starts with your hand facing inward toward your forehead and it flips really quickly so that it comes up by the side of your hand and your palm faces out. And it just looks like, I know you didn't just say that. It's such a womanly, angry gesture and I love it.
Awobo is a local designer and belly dance instructor at her own company, Opera Scura. She says the changing social dynamics of Oakland are also being felt in the dance community.
We're already kind of losing here in the Bay Area all of the really amazing folk arts and the homegrown feeling, and so we need to keep everything we can get. We need to keep it all here and not let it get sold out and to keep people interested so that places like this can survive.
Yalisa, too, is worried about the survival of the arts community here in Oakland, where she's made her home.
I love Oakland so much. You know, the arts community is important here. It gets short shrift here. It needs more coverage. We need just so much more here.
Yalisa and Caminos Flamencos aren't just working to keep the tradition of flamenco alive. They're also contributing to Oakland's thriving art scene by encouraging students of all ages to engage in the culture and the spirit of an indigenous art form. But Yalisa says there's more work to be done.
I feel it's really important for the arts to be not only covered here, but understood, supported, preserved. It's really important. It's not just flamenco.
Dancers here in Oakland are proud to be part of such a strong arts community. It is their hope that more is done to highlight and support the work that they're doing. In East Oakland, I'm Sabah Williams for Cross Currents.
That story was created through a partnership with Community Media Fellowship Oakland Voices for our project Sights and Sounds of East Oakland. You can come take part in a live performance next weekend, March 2nd and 3rd. That's at the Eastside Arts Alliance. More information is at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
That's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Marisol Medina Cadena, Nina Gensler Debs, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega Welch, Andrew Seltzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Jackie Sajiko, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by San Francisco-based rock band Swamp Child. They'll play at the Hotel Utah tomorrow night. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. This year.